fist and bone. Perhaps the two most important philosophical problems could be formulated as follows, namely, how do we know and what do we know? And in both fields you have quite explicit ideas about the interrelationship, and I would like you to ask first to say something about the first question, namely, how do we know? Because that's, so to say, the key, perhaps, to the second question, what do we know?
Well, that's a difficult question. I'm not sure I thought about it. What would you mean by how do we know, precisely?
Well, in the sense that that question is touching, let's say, the questions of logic, epistemology, and so on, you know?
Yes.
And dependent a little bit of your own philosophical system or point of view. Let's say many philosophers will say that the ideas we have about our own intelligence and so on is pretty determinative for what we can say at all about reality.
Yes, well, you raise the question of to what extent our perception is conditioned by our ideas, by our thought, as I understand it. Is that it?
Not even so much perception. I mean, you have, for example, in an interview, you have brought out the idea as followed. You said, and that was in an interview with René Weber, thought itself can bring you to this experience of wholeness in so far as it is able consistently to cease to reflect anything other than itself. And later on in the text you call that an enactment of wholeness.
Yes.
Well, this text is not that easy to understand. I mean, you will understand that I talk partly interviewing you with some public, so to say, in the back of my mind. In other words, if I say it is difficult to understand, then I talk a little bit as a kind of intermediary.
Yes, I see the question. Oh, go ahead. Wait, do you have more to say?
No.
The question is the relationship then between thoughts and whatever it may refer to or reflect. Now, see, in the first instance, when we're fairly naive and direct, then thought may be regarded as providing a kind of abstract reflection of what has been experienced or perceived by and in terms of what is general and particular. You see, our immediate perception may be very concrete and direct, and then we, over a period of time, we find similarities and differences, right? And we organize the whole thing through the general and the particular. Now, our thought does not directly reflect exactly what happens, but it always puts it in terms of categories. The category is probably the basic aspect of thought. Now, a category comes from a Greek word meaning something like sheep, a flock of sheep. The word gregarious in English has the same root. But we put things together that belong together, and we put things apart that belong apart in other categories. See, that is the beginning of thought. Now, that is general in the sense that our categories are established not by just adding things together, but by finding out in general what they have in common, or in the general way in which they are different. And we therefore organize the general and the particular. Now, the two words which are operative here are select and collect. You see, we collect things together. That is, the word collect really means to gather together, and select is to gather apart. So we gather things together, and at the same time we keep them apart. And we can give names to these categories and also represent them by images. And in that way, our thought does not represent an actual concrete object, but it is an abstraction representing something general and particular. But the particular is not the concrete actuality any more than the general is. The particular is still a special case of the general, right? Because particularity is general.
Mm-hmm.
And we see differences in general, right?
But do I understand you well if you imply by what you're saying about the general and the particular that the way our mind is structured, at least our language is structured, perhaps our mind doesn't have to work along these lines always, but at least our language is structured in such a way that we cut and we collect and so on. But are you also of the opinion that you could apply these notions of concreteness and abstractness and so on reality itself? I mean, can you even make the jump?
Well, you see, that raises the question of what is reality, because, you see, reality, we now organize categories that are more and more general, categories of categories, and coming to some of the most general ones. Now, say reality and unreality are a category, you know, just as the general and the particular, necessity and contingency. You see, we keep on organizing thought in terms of more general and more abstract categories, see, causality and chance, or indeterminism and indeterminism, time and space. You can see that thought is constantly organizing these categories into higher and higher structures. And even the question of reality gets into the question of, we are still in the question of category. You see, this is a deep problem. What is the meaning of thought, really?
But if I follow you well, and we try to minimalize the problem, then we perhaps could say, well, listen, this is just a question which has perhaps nothing to do with anything outside language, but has only to do with the internal logic of the words we are using. Like also, I mean, in your book, in one of the chapters, I think about the real mode, chapter 2 and all these things, mm-hmm. Implicate order. But let's say you still are very conscious about the question that if you use a certain concept, it has always its logical counterpart, just in the field of the internal logic of the meaning. In other words, the question how far you, so to say, can apply this terminology upon something outside of terminology.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very subtle question. You see, that I don't think that the terms of logic are directly exist outside the terminology. You see, that insofar as thought is reflecting something outside of itself, that any more than, say, the lines or words which appear here are directly reflecting what they're talking about. That is, the terms of logic are an order introduced by thought. I think that logic, insofar as it is fixed and made formal, requires categories. They can be called sets sometimes, because a category and a set are essentially the same meaning. And saying thought is constantly moving toward trying to determine, you know, define its categories more precisely as well as more generally. Now that makes it useful, you see, because it's because thought is general that it can be useful. You see, if thought merely referred to the particular instances which we knew, then it would be no use. It must go beyond that. Through the general and the particular, it goes beyond, because the general extends it beyond, and the particular is also a form of the general which allows us to narrow it down to some new case, right?
Yeah. But, you know, the question I just was asking you, where would you like, so to say, to make the jump that the language we are using is really saying something upon something outside a language? And the question I'm asking it has naturally to do with the well-known remark that many people say that in your field of quantum mechanics, it is impossible to say something really valid in with our ordinary language. You can perhaps do it with mathematical equations and so on, but, you know. So I'm very interested if you share that opinion, and also if you are of the opinion that the language of mathematics, I talk now, so to say, I use language then in a symbolic way, but you can also say, well, that is also a language, you know, different kinds. If that is a better tool for understanding, or perhaps even something like quotation marks describing, quotation marks closed, and so on, than our ordinary language.
Well, mathematics,
mathematics
is better for some purposes and not for others. You see, it can be much more precise, and you can draw conclusions logically from it much further than you can. Ordinary language, being imprecise, allows for a limited use of logic. And on the other hand, it has a certain, the mathematics, just because it is so precise, is very narrow and limited in many ways as to what it can do. You see, it's a limited system. Now, I think we need to bring both together myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to sort of change the context a little bit of the discussion and say that when you raise the question of what is the meaning of thought, you see, or language. Now, I think that there are two kinds of use of language, prose and poetry, you see. Usually people think prose is exact and right, and poetry is rather vague and so on. But all evidence is that people, more poetic types of talk began first, you see. Now the word poesis in Greek means to create or to make, you see. That something creative is involved in the use of language. And and I would like to bring out what I mean. I would like to discuss a metaphor, you see. Now, a metaphor, an assimile. Now, a simile is a direct comparison, saying this is like that. But when you say it's like, you also mean it's unlike. It's like it in certain respects, unlike it in others, right? If you if you keep on elaborating a simile, you eventually get prose, right? You see, I think prose is an elaborate simile. We say the world is like this in certain ways and unlike this in others. It never says the world is this or is not this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, we are building something, a likeness of the world and an unlikeness.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using this as a kind of map. A map is like the territory in certain ways, unlike it in others, right? Because, you know, you can't walk on the map and so on. So, it doesn't have as much, the map has much less detail than the territory. It has many things in it that are not there. The countries are green and blue.
Yeah, the famous sentence of Korzybski, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So that, I think Korzybski had a lot to say on that point, which was good.
Yeah.
Now, now then the question is, a map is a kind of prose, put in the drawing, but you see the metaphor is an implied comparison, you see. It is not stated. Therefore, the mind must search for what the comparison is. And my own feeling is that the brain will go directly into an implicate order to do this. You see that it does not the explicate order is the prosaic order of like and unlike. But the implicate order is the direct order of grasp, of understanding. And therefore, now I think mathematics as well as ordinary language can be used both poetically and prosaically. That in the creative mathematician, it starts as a metaphor, and gradually it's elaborated into a whole bunch of theorems and axioms and postulates, and it becomes prose, right?
In this context, I had to think several times about it when I was preparing this talk, that in Zen Buddhism, art, or to put it in more general term, aesthetics and the experience, the aesthetical experience, is so to say more important than, let's say, the ethical one or the moral one. The moral one is for practical purposes.
Yeah.
But the aesthetic one is, so to say, to grasp the real essence of life.
Yes, well, the moral one is prosaic. The morals, it is impossible to put morals poetically. sometimes also prose is used in a in a poetic sense. You see, like when people make Zen statements, I mean, absurd prosaic statements may be a kind of poetry. But the aesthetic, and you see, I say that the grasp of something, the perception of something, is the essential point, and that takes place in a way that cannot be analyzed. It's all unfolded. Now, fundamentally, we must grasp the relationship between ourselves and the rest of the world in that way. You see, that it cannot be fully elaborated prosaically without contradiction, you see, to say. Because if we attempt to separate ourselves from the world, we are creating a contradiction, you see. So if we say, here is my thought and there is the world, that is a contradiction, right? In some rough sense, they can be separated.
Do you mean now contradiction in the formal sense, in the logical sense, or do you mean contradiction in the sense of an opposition?
Well, a conflict, you see, in the sense that a contradiction that leads to a conflict, if you try to act according to it. That, you see, the process of thought is going on in the brain, which is connected with the whole world, right? It's affected by the whole world. Action is going out and in. The very content of thought is flowing in from the world, from other people.
But if you would, let's say, if you think about our thinking in terms of matter, in terms of biochemistry, in terms of physiology, then you could say, okay, there is a good chance that there is somehow a kind of continuum. You know?
Yeah.
But the other question, can our own intelligence, let's say the way we think and what we think, can that also influence more than just our own body? I mean, the two questions are somewhere interrelated.
Well, they must influence. You see, everything that has appeared in the world has come from our way of thinking, you see, or the whole world of society.
Yeah, sure.
Now,
but let's say, if you say the universe would be incomplete without us, what do you mean by that statement?
Well, that's a complex statement. I see, the question is whether the universe is complete, you see. or whether it means anything to say that, you see, or whether there is not an inherent sense of incompleteness in anything we say about the universe, because what we say is part of the universe, you see. If we have a new insight or a new perception, things mean something different to us, our action will be different, you see. Our action is part of the universe. So there's no separation between what something means to you and the action which comes, right? The meaning, the intention, to mean, when I say it, I mean to do it, means I intend to do it. If something means something to you, your intention is formed accordingly, you see. Say, if a shadow on a dark night means an assailant, you will start to run. Your whole body will, the adrenaline will flow, the heart will beat. But if it means a shadow, then a very different action follows. So the meaning is part of the reality. Right? Since we are constantly seeing meaning anew, it seems to me that reality is constantly being created.
You have caused during a lecture, if I remember well, April 6, 1977, you must have, in Berkeley, you must have stirred up a lot of good dust. Because I remember that in Zukav's book, The Dancing Woolly Masters, he is referring especially to your second lecture for physicists. And then he makes a kind of remark, and I made somewhere a note about it, which really struck me. It was in relation to this question that you were making a kind of analysis, like you like to do, about res and resi, about reality and thinking.
Thinking, yeah.
And that reality means everything you can think about.
Yes.
Includes that then also lies, illusions? illusions?
Yes, illusions are real, but they're misunderstood.
Wrong theories?
Yeah, they're all part of reality. You see, a wrong theory may have a tremendous effect. You see, for example, a wrong theory in politics could destroy the world, right? Therefore, wrong theories are as real as right theories, but they are confused and they lead to conflict. You see, a right theory is one which leads to harmonious action. That's our test, right? Which not merely action outside, but inside in the way of reason. And a wrong theory leads to a disharmony, first inside when we let it unfold, and then outside when we act. So we would prefer to see the disharmony inside before we produce it outside. Then we don't have to destroy things, right?
May I ask you just a question, between on a more personal level, if using, symbols or comparisons, if somebody, and I am doing it right now, would ask you, if you have to make a choice as a kind of label, as a kind of symbol, and you may choose between being named a Confucianist, a Taoist, kind of Zen Buddhist, kind of Hinduist, a kind of Buddhist, and so on, and you have many, many different forms, naturally, again, within these different categories, do you have a certain predilection to say, well, I feel close to, for example, to, let's say, if I listen to this story about harmony, you know, that's, so to say, right out of the Chinese preoccupation.
Yes, I do feel close to some of these Oriental ways of thinking. I've been very close to a man called Krishnamurti, who came originally from India. He spent a lot of time in the West, but essentially he himself has said that, he has developed his own approach, but the nearest to him would be Advaita Vedanta, is what he himself has said. But I think that they have a lot to offer. I mean, I think there's a limit. I'll try to say what my attitude is. I think that there's something inadequate about the Eastern philosophy in the sense that it led to a kind of stagnation. Both in China and in India, and though it was very good in many ways, and it appeals to me in many ways, and there's obviously something inadequate in the Western philosophy, in that it leads to fragmentation, conflict, and tremendous destructiveness, as well as great tendency to construction, scientific achievement. The Western approach, in some way, has been inadequate because we are now threatened with the destruction of our civilization, or even worse. And the East, faced with this, has not responded from its own philosophy, but in general it's adopting the Western philosophy, which again suggests something must be inadequate there. I think it's wrong that they should adopt the Western philosophy, but still, many of them feel they have to. So I think that we are faced with a challenge now, which is new, and we have got to perceive a new way of something new, a new meaning for the whole thing.
But you still have a little bit evaded my question, and if my question doesn't fit you, you naturally have to say that too. But let's say, if I would have to answer it for myself, if I'm dreaming or feeling very old, then I, for example, feel I become an old Chinese guy. I mean, I don't become an Indian old guy or a Japanese old guy. I just become a Chinese old guy. I know that.
If I
like it or not. And now, what I'm asking you is, because my feeling, reading through your text and interviews, is that there is indeed a tremendous amount of not so much concrete to indicate, but for example that your ideas about the implicated order have a lot to do with the principle or the law of independent origination in Buddhism.
Yes.
Or if you say you can't catch it this way or that way. You have to do both. And at the same time you say thought is non-thought, non-thought is thought. You just shift it. So to say you believe in, not in the third principle of Aristotle, you believe that the third principle can be excluded, the either-or principle.
Yeah.
Okay, that is the second question. For example, the Indian philosopher Narayana is in this field one of the big authors who also didn't believe in the necessity of the third principle. Your exposé about the knowledge function of poetry or art in general is also one of the basic ideas in Eastern philosophy. With other words, I mention now three different topics: mm-hmm. aesthetics, logic, the third principle which you don't accept, and the principle of independent origination, which I, so to say, when I would have to write at length about your book, I mm-hmm. just would start to say, look here, there you have this text, there you have that text. What Mr. Bohm is doing, in fact, is from out his own background, perhaps even without reading too much mm-hmm. about all that stuff, developing along his own development a certain philosophy, a cosmology, which at the end has many of the profound ideas mm-hmm. from ABC in the East.
Well, you may well be right. I mean, it's I have read some of the Eastern philosophy, but I would have spontaneously moved in that way, probably. That is the notion that the observer and the observed are one, and has always, that was what most interested me about quantum mechanics, and that is a very strong notion in the East. I felt that that question is really a crucial question for the whole discussion.
Yeah, I agree. I will come to that, but perhaps I may ask your opinion about Zukav's statement, saying here that it is ironic that while Bohm's theories are received with some skepticism by most professional physicists, they would find an immediately sympathetic reception among the thousands of people in our culture who have turned their backs on science in their own quest for the ultimate nature of reality. If Bohm physics, or one similar to it, should become the main thrust of physics in the future, the dances of East and West could blend in exquisite harmony. Physics curricula of the 21st century could include classes in meditation. If you read something like that, and I guess you will have read it, or otherwise your friends will have still told you, you know, that's the way it goes. How do you feel when you are reading something like that? Because at one side it is nice, and the other side, you dislike to take advantage of you.
Yeah, well, I feel on one side it's good, obviously. I feel that it's something not quite adequate about it, you see. I'm glad that people want to look at it that way, but I feel something more is needed. Something more is needed.
Uh-huh. And could you define it?
Well, that's what I was trying to say, that I think that it's not so much a synthesis of East and West, because I don't think they can be put together, but rather a new creative vision is needed. You see, every society started, according to Toynbee, by a creative vision from some people. And it rose on a curve, unfolding this creative vision. When it was exhausted, the curve began to fall. Now, I think the Eastern society had that creative vision, and then it began to sink. They began to elaborate the vision rather than unfold new creation. And the West has been rising high, but it does look as if it's on the way down. I mean, we don't know for sure, but it does not look promising. You see, the Western vision unfolded, was built up during the Middle Ages, on the basis of the old classical culture of Rome and Greece, coming in contact with the new people in Europe. And they had a tremendous explosion of energy. And out of that, I think, grew our Western civilization that we have today. But I have the distinct feeling that that vision is no longer, even though science is progressing, that the vision itself is no longer there. That it is progressing on lines that are more or less like what you would expect. And that it is not affecting people deeply outside of that particular scientific field. You see, that I don't think it's reading, you know, all these computers and getting to the moon and so on has had much, people haven't taken all that much notice of it.
Let's say in the first two chapters of Holmes' this implicated order, where you are talking about the fragmentation of our culture, I think that some of your analysis about the way science has been developed is at the source, perhaps, of such a fragmentation.
Well, it has contributed, I would say, because science is so important in our culture, and it has contributed several ways. One, by way of contributing to the worldview, a fragmentary worldview, a view of man as fragmented, and the whole world is fragmented. And secondly, it has led us to analyze problems in bits, so that we have a tremendous number of conflicting activities going on throughout the world. So we see when people want to do something, they generally just think of another bit to add. You see, if there's pollution, then they would add another bit to try to overcome the pollution. You see, that they're not thinking of this whole situation in which it arises. Now, the whole intention, motivation, which leads people to do it all this way.
Could it perhaps partly explain the role of science in our society and the enormous authority which scientists have, at least as a group, so to say, as a class, that, like some people like to say, that scientists have somehow taken over the role of the priest in former times? And if that would be true from a sociological point of view, then it also implies a special responsibility, like Chomsky has been often talking about.
Well, I'm not sure that scientists have taken over the role, a few of them may, but mostly they've been given the role that people have given, since religion has been also a decaying force, partly because of science making implausible the cosmology and metaphysics on which religion tends to be based. So, therefore, people still feel the need for religion, you see, and you find them trying to put religious energy, say, into politics and revolutions, and they want to have some sense of knowing what it's all about and so on, and they turn to the scientists who seem to know something, and who talk with authority and so on. And some scientists possibly may relish that role, but I think most scientists are indifferent to it. So the scientists are not really equipped or motivated or do not have the intention necessary to take on such a responsibility, that they really want to do their jobs, right? In any case, the priests didn't do it all that well. otherwise, we wouldn't be in the mess we are today, you see. Whatever went wrong, it goes back to what went wrong before. So something was wrong with religion, which allowed this situation to develop, something inadequate. It was not somehow meeting what people wanted or needed.
Coming back to your remark about quantum physics, you were mentioning that the question of the observer and the observed is one of the most interesting ideas, perhaps also for a larger public. In relation to this, let's say, to the meaning of quantum mechanics, could you elaborate that a little bit? How can you, let's say, make clear to a larger public that there is such an intimate, direct relationship between the observation or the instruments we are observing and the effects upon?
Yes, well, the first point is to ask, what does quantum mechanics say about the nature of reality? You see, my own feeling is that you cannot understand epistemology apart from understanding ontology, or the nature of reality.
Well,
there.
Well, that was what I was referring to.
Yes, but you see what you're
understanding.
Yes, but it's very hard to get a direct link between your ideas of the nature of reality and reality. That, and I think it's more poetic, is what I was trying to say. But you cannot actually elaborate those of the linkages in a great way, to a great extent. Now, we have a sort of an intuitive feeling of the reality, you see, which is both within us and without us, right? I think that comes before the analysis, right? And that sense of reality from experience and so on. And the analysis can merely unfold in more detail what it is meant, right?
So that means that, to put it in a historical term, that that the notion of truth in the Greek word aletheia,
yeah,
in which the A of the alpha is the,
yeah,
alpha prefons, eh?
Yes.
Is more or less the view you are taking, namely, aletheia would mean that what is hidden,
mm-hmm,
gets revealed.
Yes, well, it means, I was told, not, you know, waking up from sleep or something, not sleeping as well, right? Aletheia also means sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there are two aspects. One is to wake up within.
Well, yeah, that is stuff with hypnosis, yeah.
Well, no, to...
Hypnosis.
No, but I meant that
he
the...
meant to dream and...
But so. To wake up from the dream, right?
Yeah.
And the other is to, as you say, to uncover.
To uncover.
Right, to reveal, to display, to show, right?
Mm-hmm. But that's your, if I understand you well, Professor Bohm, then, let's say, your idea about truth is primarily as something you discovered.
No, I think it would be very difficult to say it exactly that way. That, you see, the word truth has many meanings now. You see, in English, the word true means honest and straight and faithful. Right? They always talk of a true line meaning a straight line, right? A true man meaning straight man, right? And then, so in Latin, the word verus for true means that which is, right? It's the same as the English were. Right? And if you said it, it means being honest and faithful to that which is, you see. So the truth has two sides. I mean, the person has to be true within and also true to that which is, right? Which is the whole, right? Now, to a certain extent, we can say this requires waking up and to whatever it is which is interfering with this honesty. See, one of the major barriers to truth is actually the conditioning of the mind, which is resisting perception of anything new, right? Because that may be disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to say what is truth is a poetic question, really. See, it seems beyond the possibility of being given as a simile, right? Hmm.
No, I share, I totally agree with you, but yeah, so to say, we still have to try to do it with this kind of primitive language, at least what I'm using. But let's say the tension between truth as a discovery and along the other pole in the history of Western philosophy, namely, truth as an invention.
It can be both, you see.
Okay, well, that will...
you see, it can be creation. You see, the creation of a new perception. You see, that truth requires a creative perception, you see, of something new, which takes place, you know, beyond the level of words, and which can then unfold into language or... You see, as it gets elaborated and it turns into prose and becomes rather fixed, and then whatever is stated is both true and untrue. You see, I think this is along the lines of Korzybski, right?
Yeah, but let's say, to come back to this point, if you say, with all the necessary restrictions you are making to what we really can express a clear way in language, but if truth has at one side that element of a discovery or getting awake, and along the other side there's also something of an invention or creation.
Yeah.
You know, could you, let's say, because therefore I was making this kind of little invasion around the definition of truth, could you show this polarity of which for many philosophers and historians of philosophy implies two different lines, two different ways of looking at life, but that doesn't matter here. But could you elaborate that in relation to your own specialism as quantum physicist?
Well, let me I'll illustrate this with Newton first. You see that?
Yes.
Now you see, let's consider Newton's discovery of the law of universal gravitation. Now, you see, we can trace its roots to the ancient times when people thought that celestial and earthly matter was basically different. It just seemed the common sense view.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then gradually, during the modern times, there accumulated a lot of evidence that they are not really different, that the moon behaves like a rock, and that the planets have all sorts of complications. In other words, that if you go into all the details, you see that celestial and earthly matter are not really fundamentally different, right?
Mm-hmm.
That evidence accumulated for that. The mind is compartmented, saying you have celestial matter and earthly matter as a result of the past. You grow up that way. So people on the one hand, educated people knew that earthly matter was the same as heavenly matter, but on the other hand, they had a compartmented mind. Now, so when people did not ask themselves the question, why isn't the moon falling? You see, if the moon is a hunk of rock, it should fall. Right? Nobody asked the question, because it seemed so natural to say it, just as children, it's different, it belongs up in the sky. Now, you see, Newton is reputed to have seen this new perception at the moment by watching an apple fall from a tree. So you can very readily surmise that he could have thought that as the apple, that his question in his mind, in the back of his mind, was why isn't the moon falling? He suddenly said, it is falling, just like the apple and the moon are the same. And all matter is the same, they're all falling, so gravitation is universal, right? Then he only had to explain why it doesn't reach the ground because of the circular motion. So now you can say that this new perception, first of all, was waking up to get free of the compartments which are unconscious, right? And then the creative new perception, which was to bring together all of matter in respect of falling, and then one found that that was the question emerged from a great deal of experience. It was not just a question arbitrarily posed. Therefore, such a perception was likely to be relevant to the actual fact, and it wasn't long to show that it actually did harmonize with the fact, right? So, and could be extended into new domains and showing its correctness. So I think that whole thing is a movement, an unfoldment, and all of these things play their part.
If you use in this context the word unfoldment, I don't know if if you have been reading in the past, philosophers like Bergson, but like I was making a kind of comparison with your work and certain Eastern recurrent ideas, like the principle of independent origin, which is very close to what you say about the implicate order and its creative force. If you use terms like the unfolding, does that imply what Bergson calls a kind of élan vital?
Well,
kind of
vital principle.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to say.
Do you see it also as progress, or is it, let's say, like in the Hinduistic vision, like the lotus flower opens itself up and will die and opens it up and die?
Well, I think that both may be in there, but you see a great deal of, from moment to moment, it's just the unfoldment like the flower. You see, now even the flower evolves gradually as the generations of flowers unfold. But Therefore, we may be able to detect the line of evolution after a while. That is another way of of abstracting it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that the creative energy unfolds into form, but any form is transitory and dies away, and there may be a replication of that form approximately, but then a new form may arise. And with regard to the mind, a major question is, whether the mind is free to unfold new forms, or whether it is conditioned to hold to the old ones. That is, see, when people raise the question of freedom, which we could raise here, you may talk about freedom of choice, but I think that is a wrong question, if you take choice, in practical affairs, you don't particularly want freedom of choice, because if you choose what kind of apples to buy or what kind of car to buy, you would like to know enough to know that it was done right, When you have all the factors available, then the thing is determined. Now, you would not regard it as freedom to be ignorant of the nature of the car you were buying, so you could choose a bad car, So, when it comes to the mind, is there freedom of choice? If you try to choose whether you're going to be good or bad, but the question of freedom of choice generally arises only in the face of desires which are destructive. The choice to be good tends to arise when the need to choose to be good arises because people find themselves desiring things that are destructive,
Mm-hmm.
Now, those desires are conditioned, they are not free, nor is the attempt to resist them is not free, because it's a reaction to... In other words, one has a desire for something destructive and then a wish to resist, which both are a sort of restricted mechanical movement, right? Now, I think that freedom consists of freedom to unfold in a natural way, in a natural, harmonious way. And if you're not free to unfold that way, then you're restricted, you're not free. If you are driven either by external circumstances or by your own internal conditioning to do things which are not really your natural need, then you're not free, right? You see what I'm trying to say?
A traditional way of discussing freedom in philosophy is in terms of the capacity of explicit self-reflection.
Yes, well, that brings us back to the observer and the observed. The question of the observer and the observed not only arises in quantum mechanics, it arises in the attempt of the mind to observe itself, right? The point we sort of let the question go, but there's a great similarity between the quantum mechanical question and the psychological question. So maybe I should go into that. Now, one of the things that most interested me about quantum mechanics was that it just led to this. Now, to begin with, we say that quantum mechanics implies a very different nature of reality from classical physics. Now, classical physics implies that everything is made more or less of separate parts which are determinate, which interact only locally and so on, and continuously and causally. And in quantum mechanics, we find that action is what is called, in the form of what is called quanta, which are discrete and indivisible, that each unit of action cannot be, the fundamental units of action cannot be divided. So it means, in some sense, movement cannot be analyzed beyond a certain point. Now, it's through movement of action and interaction that all parts of matter are interrelated and make up the whole, right? So it's as if all matter in movement were constituted of a set of links which were indivisible.
Yeah, but just wondering, if you talk about interrelatedness, to make up the whole, then you are somehow contradicting your own text. If you say that when you talk about a flux, or to say the fundamental reality would be such that you can't even talk this way.
Yes, well, it's true that you can't fundamentally talk that way, but in another sense, in some approximation, there are relatively independent parts. Now, but let me change the thing a little and say that that in this flux, the movement is shown to be constituted of indivisible links. That, see, if there is a flux, there are two possibilities. One is it could be analyzed as divided into a finer and finer flux. Or the other is that you cannot divide this without fundamentally changing its nature. Right? Now, quantum mechanics says that you can't divide that flux without changing the nature of what is, right? Now, therefore, the very being of certain reality implies that that flux is not divided. Right? Now, the flux, therefore, of the whole universe is not divided, but the fundamental units are very small, so that approximate division is possible, so that ordinary objects can be regarded for practical purposes as separate. Now, nevertheless, in a finer description, this separation is wrong. Right? Hmm?
I understand.
Yes. So, if we consider whatever is called the observed object in the observing apparatus, then this holds, that if we are observing something at a very fine level of accuracy or sensitivity, then the individual quanta become important, and this division between the observing apparatus and what is observed cannot be maintained, right, without fundamentally altering the nature of the whole situation and turning it into something else. Right? And that is the way, say, Niels Bohr put it, that if we have a whole experimental arrangement, a situation, in order to observe, say, an electron, then we have an electron microscope, for example, then we observe a spot somewhere in a photographic plate indicating an electron, but we must discuss the meaning of that spot for the position of the electron, right? The spot is of no interest, is that clear? It's only what it means that it's of interest. Now, the electron lens tells the meaning of the spot, you see, because from the position of the spot, you know from how the lens functioned where the electron must have been. Is that clear?
Yeah.
If there were no lens, it wouldn't tell you anything. Now, in classical physics, it's always possible to know exactly where, to find an exact meaning for that spot, to know where the electron was and how fast it was going. But here you find, because of this indivisible quantum, that the meaning of the spot cannot become precisely defined. So a certain ambiguity, a lack of precise meaning. And that also is an expression of of this wholeness, that the form of the experimental conditions and the meaning of the results are one whole that can't be analyzed. That if you get a certain result, what it means depends on the whole set of conditions and cannot be, you know, as abstracted and separated from those. So through that you see that at a fine level, what anything means depends on the whole context and cannot be separated. This would also be a good Chinese notion, I think. I mean, if you see an ancient Chinese picture, you get that impression, right?
But, Professor Bohm, you also have stirred up a lot of questions and reactions with your proposal of hidden variables.
Yeah.
And in which you, I think it happens in chapter 4 of Holiness and its Implicate Order, but in which you argue against, let's say, the whole Copenhagen group, Niels Bohr, also against Heisenberg, von Neumann, and so on. And you must correct me right away, but I got the impression, reading it, that it is like you sketch and picture a kind of geological picture, or archaeological picture, if you like, of different layers with a certain autonomy in their mutual relationships, and that you say, in terms of that uncertainty principle of Heisenberg, that if you assume there is, there is again a subquantum level of which we would know, which we still don't, but certain, so to say, characteristics and so on, that perhaps with that level it would be possible to solve certain puzzles like are expressed by the principle of uncertainty of Heisenberg.
Yes, I think that this is a complex question.
But I formulated it correctly.
Yes. This goes into another question. I perhaps could discuss it historically. I wrote a book, Quantum Theory, which I had here, and
I was 52.
I finished it by about 50 late 50. Now, I wrote it in order. Because I was, I started out from Bohr's point of view, and I would...
Is Niels Bohr the man of whom you say which had the biggest influence on you as a teacher, or as...
No, you see, I never had much contact with him, I must explain it, I was in Berkeley, California, as a graduate student, and I discussed quantum theory a great deal with a man called Joseph Weinberg, who...
Weinberg?
Weinberg, yes. Who was a tremendous proponent of Niels Bohr.
Like this?
Yes. B-E-R-G, yeah. He was a tremendous advocate of Niels Bohr, and he made a great impression on me, and I also had a course from Oppenheimer from that point of view, and then when I came to Princeton, I thought I would try to understand it better by teaching the course in quantum mechanics and writing a book. So from Bohr's point of view, which I favored naturally at that time. And when I finished it, I wasn't entirely satisfied that it was clear. I sent copies to I wasn't satisfied that it gave a good description of actuality. It seemed that you reduced everything to a phenomena, to what an observer would see. And you would not be able to look at the world as a whole that way, because if you can only deal with phenomena, and the apparatus themselves are ultimately only phenomena, and the people and so on, then what is behind it, you see. So it seemed that you couldn't really get it entirely clear. And in order to understand this better, at that time I had an idea of a scattering problem. You send the waves, quantum mechanical waves, against a nucleus. They are scattered. They spread out, and yet you can observe a particle at a certain spot, not like a spread out wave, right? But in order to understand that, I thought of a second wave as one wave spreading out, a second wave coming in to that place where it would be detected, that there would be a relationship between those two waves. See, that was a sort of a foreshadowing anticipation of the implicate order, the unfoldment of the second wave. To try to explain the actual process, whereas quantum mechanics, I say, cannot explain the actual process because it has only the one wave. If you have another wave and then another one and another one, and you can then explain the whole thing, right? So I felt that quantum mechanics as now constituted was a fragmentary theory discussing one fragment of reality. You see. Now then, meanwhile, I'd sent the book to various people, including Einstein, Bohr, and Pauli, and I received a very enthusiastic reply from Pauli, and I didn't get a reply from Bohr, but Einstein was very interested, and I was in Princeton. He telephoned that he would like to discuss it, so we did discuss it, and he felt the book was as good as you could do from Bohr's point of view, but he still was not convinced. And we discussed it, and he made very similar objections, to what I'd been making, very strongly, and that encouraged me to look more strongly still. So
You mean Einstein was making similar objections?
Yes, to what I was doing,
In relation to Bohr.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that probably caused me to question Bohr more strongly than I would have. I was already implicitly questioning Bohr by that second wave, but and I soon came on this other model of the causal interpretation, which was to say the electron was a particle accompanied by a wave that acted on by this new quantum potential. Now, this quantum potential had very strange properties. It did not necessarily decrease with the distance, so it could introduce effects of things on each other at long distance, and would then explain to some extent this wholeness of quantum mechanics. And I pursued this. At that time, I didn't see any relationship of the two, but my feeling was it might give some insight into... I didn't particularly believe this was a good theory, but I thought any theory that would work at all would give some insight that was lacking in the previous theory.
But in, let's say, with this idea of that quantum potential being able also to work at a distance, you went against Einstein.
That's right. He never liked the idea for that reason, you see. So, but I think what this model taught me was that quantum mechanics has some new features, and by producing a theory, a model in which both classical and quantum mechanics could be compared directly, I could see what was really new about quantum mechanics, which was this new feature, right? Now, there is this strong connection, at a possibility of a strong connection at a distance. In ordinary situations, it doesn't exist, but in certain situations, it does. Now,
what do you mean in ordinary situations?
Well, you see, when there are certain cases, it said when the wave function can be factorized into two parts, then the two parts are independent. They're not strongly connected at a distance. But with more general wave function, they may be strongly connected at a distance. Now, in ordinary classical situations, the conditions for independence are very nearly satisfied. So the ordinary experience can be explained, our ordinary experience of independence, while we still see that basically that we have wholeness. In fact, the entire universe enters into the operation of each part, right? Now, this is a new feature of wholeness that you see, not merely that there's a strong connection at a distance, but that the nature of this connection depends on the state of the whole, right, in a way which cannot be analyzed in terms of the parts, right? That the state of the whole precedes the understanding of the parts. So that led me to the notion that quantum mechanics implies, in the very even by just by putting it in this quasi-classical way, it became very clear that quantum mechanics goes very far toward wholeness, right? Undivided wholeness. Now, since that time, I developed the idea of applying this model to a field rather than particles. And when you apply it to the field, you find what is called a super quantum potential, which applies to the whole field all over the universe. And this super quantum potential introduces what's called a non-linear and non-local connection of all parts of the field. So the field no longer can be analyzed as separate elements. And what happens is that it is capable of organizing the field into particle-like entities, which have a certain stability. You see, so therefore, we now come to the fact that not only is everything interconnected in the whole, you know, at a long distance in ways that depend on the whole, but also the parts are organized from the whole. And this compares with the view of organism, which say the parts are organized from the whole, right? So that would suggest the universe as something, a very remarkable kind of wholeness, with relative independence possible when the wave function, when the conditions are right, but fundamentally wholeness. So we turn the view upside down. Instead of saying that we start with the parts and must explain the whole by their interaction, we say we start with the whole and must explain the parts.
And could you use the image what I was actually using already by saying that the way you look, so to say, also what you define as the implicate order, that you often say, well, yeah, the implicate order is the non-manifest order, and he is partly from a more subtle nature in terms of matter,
yeah,
and partly it goes beyond matter. With other words, if you would have to make a kind of diagram, could you, so to say, well, it is like you have kind of area which we don't give a name, and so you move up, so to say, to different areas until you get, let's say, the kind of stable stuff, at least in relation to our senses.
Yes, there are various areas, and you see, one thing I did was with the field to introduce two levels of implicate order. I call the first implicate order and the second, which I call the super implicate order. Now, We could say that the field is the first implicate order because, you see, waves fold and unfold within the field, right? Even classically. Now, the superquantum potential organizes these waves. Without that, these waves would just pass through each other and not form any stable entities, right? Now, with the super implicate order, these waves are organized to form stable structures in a way which classical physics wouldn't allow for. And
but is that super, so to say, quantum potential, is that, in your view, a more profound and deeper?
Yes, it would be deeper, yes. Yes, it should be deeper. And I think that in thought we should find something similar, that we would say that the level of thought which is organized in terms of categories would be come out from a sort of an implicate order of thought, which is a bit, which is general. But I think there's a deeper level which organizes these thoughts beyond the categories, you see, and that does not work through the categories. See, the categories are essentially the classical level of thought, you see. Or we could say prose is the classical level of thought, if we were to try to look at it that way.
But if, let's say, if you talk about a superquantum potential, that still belongs, so to say, to what we can call, in general terms, matter. If you make, let's say, the distinction in the order of the what you call in certain articles the non-manifest, I mean the non-manifest, I understand as covering the same realm, so to say, as the notion, the implicate order. Is that right?
Yes.
Or you say you may not exchange these terms. Can I exchange the term the implicate order with the term non-manifest?
Yes. What I've been trying to say is that we may introduce several gradations within the implicate order so that it may be manifest in one sense and not in the other. Say that, see, the first implicate order is non-manifest relative to the ordinary objects, but manifest relative to the second. And we can introduce that sort of idea now, that there can be a structure organized. I think, yes, go ahead.
What I wonder is why, so to say, why would you need a dimension beyond matter?
Well, yes, the question is, what do we mean by matter? You see, if we say matter is basically what can be perceived through the senses and by extension through scientific instruments, you know, with the aid of thought. Now, if there is a level of reality beyond whatever could be handled that way, we would have to say in some way it's different, right? Now, if you were to include all that, and you could include all that and call it matter, it's a partly way of using language, right?
No, sure, I agree. But let's say I try to choose my words carefully in the sense that I am using your own phrase.
Mm-hmm.
These are the words I know. Naturally, that you can, the meaning of a word depends who is using it, in which context, to whom. So if I am using it, then I am using it within the framework of your own texts. And what interests me in it is if you have reasons or arguments to say beyond what we call matter, and then not only matter in terms of our scientific or technological instruments and so on, method can also include that, includes also in your theory that super quantum potential. But even beyond that super quantum potential, I understood from your text that you assume, let's say, call it the void, call it the spirit,
yes,
call it this,
right,
or call it that. Well,
yeah.
What interests me is there for you, more or less, in the way you arrive to these ideas, a kind of, so to say, unbroken line? Or you say, no, somewhere, somehow, I make a jump there. I do that on other grounds.
Oh, well, you see, I think this comes back, this comes to this question of some of the questions we discussed before, you see, because if we say that we get beyond thought with its categories and formal logic into something creative and intelligent, we say, what, if we wish, you see, if you wish to say that this void was ultimately endowed with intelligence, then we would find it hard to say whether it was matter or mind, right? If you want to say intelligence arises only in certain combinations of matter, I don't think that will hold, right? That if we see the kind of complex structure which is in life in the brain, it's far beyond anything we could ever hope to do with our thought process to produce such a brain, right? So we say, how did it come about,
right? He tries to go very far.
What?
It's out of the record.
Yeah. Well, do you think that it could be done?
Well, let's say the question is, don't ask me. ask me.
You see, in any case, I think that there must be some quality of intelligence essentially enfolded in the implicate order of the universe. That this unfolds, you know, that it was there implicitly beforehand, and it unfolds. Now, I think that ultimately thought, we get to situations where thought cannot handle the thing, and you see, at some stage, you would have to say that, in any case, our thought is not literal, but only poetic or metaphorical. And, you know, it becomes unclear to what you mean by matter, right, at that level. Now, there are various questions that arise if you try to look at this. You see, one question is the question of the observer and the observed, you see, which we've discussed in quantum mechanics. Now, then we must discuss it in the mind, right? If quantum mechanics holds for the brain, then that question must arise, and in any case, by actual experience, it arises. And the question is, can you actually separate the observer and the observed in the mind? Now, for some small affairs, it looks as if we can, but for anything involving a total response, we can't. You see, if somebody is deeply moved by anything, he cannot separate the observer from the observed, right? See, if somebody is very angry, he cannot observe the anger and control it.
In fact, in Stendhal also, in his novel The Unknown from 1820 or something like that, writes about it, that finding something beautiful,
yeah,
is something like falling in love with it. There you see it too, in the aesthetic,
yeah,
attitude,
yeah,
you also have that unity.
Yes.
The moral attitude, you don't have to have that unity, you still
no.
to go on and not kill
well, you see, the moral attitude is more of the more formal logic, you see that. Now, see, formal logic attempts to establish this separation, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to be able to make sense of itself, it has to assume that whatever it is separate from what it's talking about. Right?
Mm-hmm. But let's say if I could put it in a line, when I was using the term unbroken line, also a phrase of, let's say, Beethoven, who died in that plane accident a couple of years ago. But if I understand them rightly, and it would dissolve my opinion, you know, you would say, let's make here two imaginary, just conceptual endings. Call this consciousness and call this matter.
Yeah.
And then, so to say, the whole stuff is going between.
Oh, well, I would say that's a good idea, but that's a good way to look at it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
See, that matter and consciousness are two abstractions, are two facets or aspects of something unknown. Now, you know, which, and therefore we, but that is a metaphor, right?
Mm-hmm.
That line is a metaphor, right? I mean, there is no line, right? Now, you
well,
have to...
Well, you say it in this, the nature of this metaphor, that, let's say, like you talk about the different levels with, depending how you observe or how you look at it and how you understand it, with more or less independence, but anyway, always interconnected, yeah, to use this terminology, which, by the way, I don't know if you know Arne Næss, a philosopher from Norway, he is also in my book. He is a fellow you would like, I think, because he goes very far in his philosophy along the same lines as you are doing. But let's say consciousness in the sense of the mechanisms, and it is not such a nice word, perhaps, but the, so to say, the structures of reality. Well, why wouldn't you call that the consciousness of reality? You know, like in all philosophies, people also have looked at nature like nature is thinking, or our...
We can look at it that way, yes, but then we'd have to say that nature is already contains intelligence then. You see that implicit, you see that nature has organized the structures necessary for thought now, and but in this case you would say mind and matter are both terms, are mere terms of extremes, which are not, you know, are like the two sides of the coin. They don't have any separate existence, right? They don't exist at all, right?
But is that your opinion, that
I think
consider it as two sides of the same coin?
That's one view which I'm in favor. You see, I cannot form a final opinion on any of this.
Yeah, no, I understand. Okay.
But I would like, it's worth exploring that view, right? I think this, we will constantly have to explore this in new directions. But you can see that if there is no... The ordinary logical analysis requires the separation of the observer and the observed, but fundamentally this cannot be maintained in the mind. Therefore, at some stage, the ordinary logical analysis cannot be applied to, neither to quantum mechanics nor to the mind, right? Now, but we still, that doesn't mean we can do nothing.
But you were just saying that mind and matter could be considered as two sides of the same coin. Is that also what you mean by the term implicate consciousness? Because I understand what you call in one of your interviews implicate consciousness, that is very similar, if not identical, to what other people often use cosmic consciousness.
Yes, well, that's a speculation that there may be this cosmic consciousness. You see, I would like to just say that my own... See, I say that ultimately, the way I've proposed it, is that all matter originates out of a void which is simultaneously a plenum of tremendous energy. Now, insofar as this plenum contains information and meaning, it is also intelligence, you see, and that out of this may arise form, right? Do you see what I'm driving at? That, see, this plenum out of which all matter arises, it will have arisen through some implicit form already in it. Now, that's exactly the way in which our ideas emerge into consciousness, right?
Do you happen to know the books of Gregory Bateson?
I know a bit about them, yeah.
Because Bateson would say that it is much more important to discuss, call it structure, call it organization, let's call it what you like in Aristotle's formative causality, that in science, and generally speaking, talking about culture, that developing insight into the formative factors is much more important than to talk about, for example, energy or whatsoever, because, well, that's there anyway. And to understand how, so to say, the structure or pattern, or how you want to call it, are all words, is functioning, that is, so to say, really what has to be in the center of our scientific interest.
Yes, well, we can say that the formative cause is very important. That's what I was saying, that, for example, the superquantum potential was the formative cause of the first level. Now, the formative cause, though, is very close to the notion of an idea, you see, as Aristotle, or as Plato used it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I have to say there's a close analogy between whatever we're now calling matter and what we have been calling mind, and that is what justifies this line that you have drawn to put one at one side and one at the other. To say that the two are very similar in basic respects, and we can have one metaphor for both, and therefore the division of mind and matter is no longer being maintained, right?
And what do you mean then within this context with the sentence that the inherent drive in metaphysical thought is to go further, to the point of being without an external content?
Yes, well, that's implicit in metaphysical thought. It may not achieve it, you see, but see, metaphysical thought is constantly aiming to grasp the whole, right?
Mm-hmm. But what do you mean with external content?
Well, content external to that thought.
But, let's say, metaphysics in terms of an as profound as possible vision or guiding idea about the final or about the basic structure of quotation marks reality can leave nothing out.
It's bound to leave something out. You see, it's merely a constant movement. You see what I'm trying to say? Metaphysics is a constant movement. It will not grasp the whole. You see that? See, that's along the lines, of course. It's, again, whatever we say something is, it isn't, because it's more and it's different, right? That it's something like it and something unlike it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, therefore, metaphysics is constantly aiming for more comprehensive perceptions of the nature of reality, right? Now, if it were to grasp the whole of reality, then nothing would be left out of it, and it would be just grasping itself, I mean, in a way.
Yeah. Well, that's what they call, I guess, Satori or something like
that. A what?
Satori. Satori.
Yeah.
Something like that. By the way, I feel that you, somehow that it would have been perhaps a nice idea when you would have dedicated your book Holmes and its implicate order to Heraclitus. I think that would have been a nice idea,
mm-hmm.
just to dedicate a book only to him.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, because Heraclitus is not only the man who got famous because of his Pantarei, everything streams statement, but also that your sensitivity for the need of paradoxes to formulate, so to say, the two sides of the same coin, even if there is, so to say, a kind of logical tension between, is very strongly there in Heraclitus' philosophy, even so far that, I can't, that in the Greek, in the Greek word bios, esti bios, that bios can mean bow, but also, as you know, life.
Yeah.
Then you get the interpretation, the question of the interpretation, what is coming first?
Mm-hmm.
Life is a bow,
mm.
and its effect is death, because it's not like that. Then you're done.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine that you would read it the other way around.
Yeah.
That the bow is life.
Yeah.
Also that you could do. So he has, so to say, he's playing around.
Yeah, with the meaning, yes.
Exactly.
I think that's the central point, that you've got to do that.
Yeah, and therefore, I'm suggesting that in the next edition, you make a little edition and you dedicate a book to Heraclitus.
Yes,
because talking about the flux, it is very nice that the river, so to say, comes back, makes a big circle.
I think also, I was going to say that every equation is a kind of paradox, you see, because you write A equal B, but unless A and B were different, there would be no point to having the equation, right? So now, you can take two attitudes to the equation. See, the prosaic attitude is to say A is like B in certain respects, unlike in others. And the poetic is to say it's a metaphor. You see, that A equals B. Now, for example, in physics, we have the Newtonian theory of particles in classical physics and the wave theory of Hamilton and Jacobian. See, they were very different things which were equated. And see, in that metaphor could have been the perception of the possibility of quantum mechanics and relativity, you see. I think that this does not always happen just when you put two different things together, but the perception is to find which of the two different things have to go together, right?
We only have left 15 minutes.
Oh, well, don't make it too exact.
No, but okay. But the interview went along very different lines than I had thought out on beforehand, in the sense that I thought that perhaps all your ideas could perhaps be explained just by using nothing else than space-time at that side of that blackboard, and so to say all the ideas at the other side, but each time, so to say, specified or translated by a kind of story or analysis of space-time, so to say, and perhaps you still feel still willing to do it in a brief time, that if you take the picture of different layers, call it, so to say, the mountain, you know, with ramifications into the earth, and you would have to say something about these different levels from, let's say, from the void, which you call the plane, full of energy, to that superquantum potential, second level, until we get into the field of what we then, with our way of understanding, feel like it is the real stuff, like Freddie Ayer in one of the interviews against Nesse. I need something, you know, using a thumb on the table and Nesse trying to discuss the whole table away. From there, the glass is on the table. Well, if you would have to do it in terms of space-time, could you give brief specific characteristics in which, so to say, the meaning of space-time is changing from this level to that level?
Yes. Of course, in the ordinary space-time, I say, is the explicate order in which everything is unfolded and separate from everything. Right? Everything is outside of everything and externally related. Right? Okay. Now, as we go deeper in the implicate order, we find everything is enfolded into everything and internally related. Is that clear what I mean?
Yeah, and what does that mean if you would have to describe that still in the notion of space?
Well, then what we have to do is to actually, we're now working on this mathematically, to get an idea which I think Wheeler calls pre-space, that there would be something deeper than space-time.
Pre-space?
Yes, which would be the order of action and connection, not necessarily located in space-time. And an order of linkages or whatever, and we say light being a fundamental notion, right? And
could you call that, for example, in if you use specific aspects of the general notion of time, is it not possible then in that level to call it the principle of simultaneity?
Well, that has not yet come out. You see, we must make this compatible with the theory of relativity, which has this considerable amount of ambiguity about what is simultaneity. Right? And you see, Leibniz, you know, has said that space is the order of coexistence and time. Leibniz.
Yeah.
Space is the order of coexistence and time is the order of successive existence. So time has to do with succession in some sense. And on the other hand, the quantum mechanics does not seem at the moment to suggest that time could be taken as in its usual sense as all that fundamental. That what I'm proposing is that we would start with something that will look at the beginning like a more abstract notion of order, and from this must emerge an explicit order. You see, instead of saying the implicit order is enfolded in the explicit order, it will turn out the other way around. A very subtle implicit order, not in space-time, contains within it an explicit order.